sound.
C. K. K.
U.
T. T. 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
I live to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. I'm Dave, and today I'm talking to our U.S. politics correspondent, Michael Aria, about the 2020 U.S. election, which is sadly not yet over. Michael writes The Shift, a weekly newsletter tracking the changing politics around Palestine and Israel across the United States. But first, I spoke to Yumna Patel, our Bethlehem-based correspondent, who filed a video report about the annual olive harvest in Palestine.
Hey, Yumna, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing pretty good. So you just finished a couple of short two-piece report on the olive harvest there in Palestine, which is now ongoing. And the newest one, the second piece, is about issues that Palestinian farmers face dealing with Israeli settlers and the violence. Mm. Impacted. You visited some Palestinian farmers trying to go and harvest their olives and dealt with some of that. Can you tell us about where they were, what their situation was, and what you found?
I'll give a little background information that, you know, people will be able to see in the video as well. Every year, you know, the olive harvest begins at the beginning of October and extends well into November, just depending on when the best time it is for individuals to harvest their olives. So, you know, the olive harvest is taking place all across the West Bank. And inevitably, what happens every single year is during the olive harvest, Israeli settlers will descend down from their settlements across the West Bank and attack Palestinian farmers, sort of terrorize them during the harvest, whether that means chopping down their olive trees right before the harvest so that they can no longer harvest them or use them, burning down the trees. There's a very common phenomenon of settlers coming and stealing the crop. So actually coming in the middle of the night and stealing all of the olives so that when Palestinian farmers go, they find that their olive trees have already been harvested and then they have nothing for the next year. And then also another very unfortunate and, you know, worrying trend that we've seen, it's been going on for years now, is physical attacks on the Palestinian farmers themselves. In many cases, Israeli settlers are armed. And if they're not armed themselves, they come under the protection of the Israeli military and Israeli soldiers who, of course, as you know, are armed and there to protect the settlers, even if the settlers are the aggressors in the situation, which is almost 100% of the time. We went to the Nablus district, is home to dozens of settlements that are notoriously violent. I mean, year round, we get hundreds of reports of settler attacks on Palestinians in the Nablus district, just because the settlers that tend to live there tend to be extremist, ultra-nationalist, right-wing, who very much believe that the land of the West Bank was given to them by God, and it is their God-given right to stake claim to this land by all means, including violence. And so that's what they do.
They don't refer to it with the modern nomenclature of the West Bank. I mean, they refer to it as the land of Judea and Samaria.
This sort of terminology has become very mainstream in Israel and amongst Israeli politicians as well. I mean, the Prime Minister of Israel, who's extremely right-wing, Benjamin Netanyahu, he also refers to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. And that's just another sort of way that Israelis, through their rhetoric, stake their claim over this land. So yeah, we went to two villages, actually. We went to a village called Burin, a village called Huwara. They're both south of Nablus City. They're quite close to each other. And they both are very close to a number of settlements and outposts that are extremely violent, including the Yitzhar settlement.
Right.
The Yitzhar settlement is well-known. Yeah, it's notorious for sort of the violent settlers that it attracts. And, you know, there's a lot of documentation out there showing that the notoriously violent group called the Hilltop Youth, which are a group of young Israeli settlers, their aim is to take over Palestinian land and expel as many Palestinians as they can through violence. That group was actually born out of the Yitzhar settlement. So that's just sort of the settlers that people are dealing with in the Nablus district. So we went to these areas, and in the town of Huwara, the day before we got there, there was a group of farmers. They went up on the hill. Their land is located up on the mountain, which is very close to where the settlement itself is. And the settlers, almost immediately after the farmers got there, the settlers came down, and we actually show video footage of the attack. And these are young settlers. They're masked, and they just sort of descended down and immediately started attacking the farmers. And so they had these huge rocks and were throwing them at them. You know, they were physically assaulting the farmers, the soldiers.
And to give a little bit of context, people who maybe aren't familiar, olive trees are typically grown on slopes. So they're grown on the hills. Palestinian villages tend to be founded in the valleys, and settlers intentionally found a settlement on the hilltops above. Mm-hmm. You just imagine that you go up onto the slope to harvest your olives. These trees take decades to reach maturity before they start producing. So for a lot of these families, they are multi-generational farmers. And by the time they're harvesting now, working on trees that are sometimes 100, 150, 200 years old.
Yeah.
And you have settlers coming down to damage them or steal the harvest or attack with the rocks. And
That's absolutely right. And it's a good clarification, just so people can get, you know, a better idea of sort of the landscape and sort of how these attacks take place. It's almost always, you know, the settlers literally have the upper ground because they're coming down from the hilltop and the Palestinians are sort of below them and trying to fend off these attacks. And then, you know, these settlers are almost always immediately joined by armed Israeli soldiers who are called out by the settlers to quote unquote defend them. And what happened in the case of the farmers in Huwara, who we interview for the video, the Israeli soldiers came and instead of breaking up the settlers and the Palestinians and instead of attempting to push the settlers back who were attacking the Palestinians, the soldiers started firing tear gas and sound bombs towards the Palestinians. Farmer who we spoke to, who was severely injured, I mean, we saw him the day after the attack. He could barely speak. He had totally lost his voice. He was limping. He could barely walk. I mean, he had bruises and cuts and bandages all over his body.
This is a man in his 50s or 60s.
Yeah, and he's in his late 50s. They totally roughed him up. They beat him. They knocked him to the ground. And there is video footage that we show in the video. You can see these settlers sort of holding these huge rocks and getting ready to throw it down on him while he's lying on the ground. And so he was really badly injured. And he told us, he said, you know, he thought that the settlers were going to kill him. And he was pleading with the soldiers saying, you know, why are you shooting at us? They're the ones that are attacking us. Why are they attacking us? You know, help us. And the soldiers continued to work sort of in tandem with the settlers until the Palestinians were forced to flee their land. And at the end of the day, that's exactly what the goal is, right? Is to inflict as much violence and as much oppression onto these Palestinian farmers so that the goal for the settlers is that the farmers don't come to their land anymore. And that eventually the settlers can take over that land and, you know, extend their control over that specific mountaintop and over the rest of the West Bank. And we highlighted this in the first video, and you sort of mentioned it, how important these trees are and how important these olives are to Palestinian families. And the farmer told us, he said, you know, I was worried for my life. In that moment, I was thinking about myself, but I was thinking about my children. I was scared that I was going to die. Who's going to take care of my children? But he was also so worried about his trees. He said, you know, these are the trees that my great grandfather, my father, they planted these trees. They took care of these trees and they were passed down to me. And I was also worried about my trees, that they were going to damage them beyond repair. Because, you know, he said he spent his whole life since he was a child taking care of these trees with his father and his grandfather. So as much as he was worried for his life and for, you know, what might happen to his children if he was killed, he was also equally worried about his olive trees and what was going to happen to them.
Those trees have provided the livelihood for generations of his family. And mm-hmm. I'm sure they expect that they're going to, he expects that they're going to provide livelihood for his children and mm-hmm. grandchildren to come. It's not uncommon for the soldiers who serve in these areas to themselves be settlers from these areas. Mm-hmm. To be attacked by settlers and then look at the military to say, please help me, but they are mm-hmm. oftentimes the same from the same communities.
Right. Yeah.
There is no recourse for Palestinians in this mm-hmm. situation.
Right. That's a point that one of the activists who we spoke to, he phrased it this way. He said, the settler is the soldier and the soldier is the settler. He said they are the same person, you know, even if they are not from the exact same settlement, or even if they're not a settler at all, at the end of the day, they work in tandem to sort of achieve the same goal, which is increasing Israeli control over Palestinian land.
Well, these are two great videos, Yumna. The first one is amazing to watch, the joyous celebration mm-hmm. of bringing in the harvest, and you mm-hmm. show what it's like when the olives get delivered to the processing facility. And turn it into the oil. The second one showing the struggle that Palestinian farmers go through just to bring the harvest in. But right. They're beautiful videos. They're well done.
You've got
a great team there of Palestinian videographers and editors working with you. So thank you so much.
Thanks, yeah. Thank you, Dave.
Medical experts warn the health system is on the verge of being overwhelmed and are calling for a lockdown.
الاتصال لاحقا. Administration opened up the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. Standing there, the President's family,
Chief Rabbi of Israel, Rav Yisrael,
and a few mealy-mouth evangelical preachers,
members of the Knesset, members of the IDF,
who are responsible for the mess that we found ourselves in,
the executive branch of the United States government,
both there and here,
to welcome the leaders,
misquoting and misinterpreting the scripture, talking about peace. Meanwhile, young Palestinian sisters and brothers who are struggling for their very lives, struggling for water, and struggling for their human dignity, stood up in a non-violent protest, saying, if we're going to die, we're going to die struggling. And yes, there may have been some folk who were violent, but we ought to know how that works out. We know what it's like to stand up and have a peaceful demonstration and have the media focus on a few violent uprisings. But you have to look at those Palestinian sisters and brothers who are struggling for their human dignity. And they have a right to self-determination. They have a right to breathe free. We need a two-state solution where all of God's children can live together. If we can't live together in the holy city, what in the world are we talking about? We hear everybody, Arabs and Cretans, isn't that what the text says? Speaking about God's deeds of power. But we saw the government of Israel shoot down unarmed Palestinian sisters and brothers like birds of prey. And I don't care who does it. It's wrong. It's wrong to shoot down God's children like they don't matter at all. And it's no more anti-Semitic for me to say that than it is anti-white for me to say that black lives matter. Palestinian lives matter. We need a Pentecostal movement.
Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Dave.
So the clip we just heard was Reverend Raphael Warnock, Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate from Georgia. He's running for election on January 5th, 2021. There was an open election on November 3rd. None of the candidates crossed the 50% threshold there in Georgia, so there will be a runoff on January 5th. He's trying to unseat Kelly Loeffler, who was appointed to the Senate seat after Johnny Isaacson retired at the end of 2019. Loeffler is the wealthiest member of the Senate. Her husband owns Intercontinental Exchange, which operates financial and commodity market exchanges in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. What does that mean? It means they own the New York Stock Exchange, among others. She also owns the women's NBA team in Atlanta. She's listed as having a net worth of $165 million, and her husband is worth $355 million. In contrast, Raphael Warnock grew up in public housing in Savannah, Georgia. He's been the senior pastor at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta since 2005. Of course, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was the co-pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in the 1960s. Not surprisingly, Wikipedia does not list Reverend Warnock's net worth. We're going to talk more about this race and Reverend Warnock in just a bit. But first, Michael, there was a major election on November 3rd. You published your Shift newsletter today with reaction to it. So let's start with the top of the ticket. Is this the outcome you expected?
I think it is the outcome I expected in terms of Biden winning, certainly. Like, the newsletter we typically focuses on Israel, Palestine, how it factors into U.S. politics. But the last couple weeks have obviously kind of addressed the presidential election and the kind of wider implications. I guess Trump's refusal to concede is kind of hovering over everything else we talk about, right? Because now there's going to be a recount by hand in Georgia. Mike Pence is headed there. We're going to talk about the Georgia runoff, and who knows how those things will potentially impact, or will they drive GOP voters to the polls? Will they drive more Democrats? It's hard to say, but the lame duck period is certainly not conventional, to put it mildly. In addition to these kind of baseless charges of voter fraud from the Trump people, you're not seeing much. They're doing virtually nothing about the fact that COVID is obviously spiking throughout the entire country. But report the other day that they plan to hit Iran with a flood of sanctions. I mean, it was reported basically a new sanction every week until January 20th. Trump envoy Elliot Abrams went to Israel this week to presumably talk over the sanctions with Netanyahu, prime minister of Israel. It's been reported that the idea behind this is effectively to sink any chance of the Biden administration re-entering the Iran deal. Iran has made public, there's been public statements from their leaders that they would like to, despite everything, I don't know why, but would like to re-enter this deal with the United States. So there's the Iran thing, ramping up sanctions. It's hard to know what to expect from Trump or the Trump administration one minute to the next. Obviously, I don't know how distracted he is from the rest of the world based on, people now reporting he's telling friends he's going to run in 2024. He's going to start a right-wing media empire to take down Fox News because he's so offended that they called Arizona early, I guess. They informed Congress, or the Trump administration informed Congress the other day that they had approved the sale of over $23 billion in advanced weapon systems to the UAE. There's still things happening on the foreign policy front when it comes to all this stuff. Mike Pompeo, he's planning, I guess, this week to become the first Secretary of State to visit an Israeli settlement in the West Bank, positioning the Republicans as a party of settlers that I think we all kind of, at this site, we kind of already associated them with that policy, but kind of just doing it more out in the open. And what will that potentially mean in terms of what Netanyahu does, or what kind of signal it sends to Netanyahu with the Biden administration incoming, and what does that mean for annexation? I just think, this stuff is all day to day, obviously, and by the time, we get off this call, there might have been other developments, but at the moment, it just seems all over the place. One more thing I forgot to mention in that chunk of things that Pompeo's had like a pretty... I mean, his week has been very notable in many ways. He obviously made headlines by implying that the Trump administration is effectively trying to do a coup and that they would transition to a second Trump administration rather than the Biden administration. There's debate online whether he was joking or not. I don't know why anybody would think these people are joking at this point. But also, this is a story that Politico reported at the end of October that we had written about, which kind of surfaced yesterday. There was that story at Politico about how the Trump administration was planning to declare a bunch of human rights organizations as anti-Semitic, pretty mainstream groups like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Oxfam, allegedly anti-Semitic for their criticisms of Israeli policies, for their criticisms of settlement expansion and human rights abuses in the occupied territories. The initial reporting made it seem like it was on the verge of happening, that there was an announcement, and then it kind of just faded away for a few weeks. Everybody got focused on the election. And now there is a report from Politico kind of following up on that, and they're saying that the Trump administration has established a new process to declare these groups anti-Semitic, and that the decision is something of a compromise because they faced so much backlash initially. So it seems like because they faced so much backlash from State Department staffers, lawmakers, and human rights organizations, that they've kind of developed a process. But Politico kind of points out in the piece that it's hard to know if this will actually happen. Much like all the stuff we're talking about right now, it's hard to know what the end game is, because all the sources that say this process has been developed say that Pompeo could just like randomly change his mind at any moment and not make the announcement. So that's just something else that's kind of happening in the background. A lot of movement and action and bad things being done by the Secretary of State while we're all focused, obviously, on this the fallout to the election.
Interesting that State Department staff pushed back on this announcement. And what's happened is the development of a process, which could be a way to institutionalize this method of declaring organizations anti-Semitic. It might have been better long-term if they had just done it arbitrarily.
Right. Yeah, it's also, that one is interesting to me too, what ends up, because you do wonder with some of the stuff, it's kind of like we talk about BDS a lot and these laws to criminalize BDS, which are passed many times in states that have, you know, virtually no connection or relationship with Israeli businesses whatsoever, mainly obviously because of the symbolism of it and what it signals and other wider policies that it points to. And it's a similar thing with this. I don't, you know, it's not like the Trump administration is trying to fund human rights groups. You know, so like the original idea as reported was that they were going to declare these groups anti-Semitic for criticizing Israel and then encourage other governments, I guess, to cut off their relationships with these organizations. So it's hard to know what that even looks like. If after that this announcement's made and it comes out of their office on anti-Semitism or whatever, what worldwide implications mean? Because, you know, it's unclear whether it would actually have any impact at all beyond the rhetoric. It's hard to say unless there's specific things that they have in mind here in terms of punishing these groups.
So you don't think we're going to coup. That's your final decision. I don't think we're going to coup. I think that the online leftist concern about a coup happening has been overblown and overestimates Trump's ability to maintain discipline you would need to move in that direction.
I think you just hit the nail on the head before you asked the question. I think when it depends what people mean by the word coup. And I think when most people picture a coup, they assume a certain level of competence. Even the botched ones typically have a plan. And it's just, I think you used the word earlier, but it is just, the administration seems to just be flailing. It's just, the messaging is all over the place from the very beginning. As soon as it seemed clear that they were going to lose, you know, they literally had some of their supporters chanting count the votes and other supporters at the same time chanting stop the count. So it's just like, that's kind of set the tone for this entire thing. And I just don't, it's not that I think, you know, Trump is going to somehow stay in the White House. You know, now there's reports that Republican people connected to him are effectively saying that he knows the gig is up, or at least people around him know it's up. You know, there's reports that his wife and other people around him have encouraged him to concede. As other people have pointed out, I think the there's much bigger long-term concerns when we talk about what this means going forward with the Republican Party. You know, this coupled with widespread voter suppression, these baseless claims of fraud. You know, you wonder what would happen. You know, like I'm old enough to remember 2000, and I know you are too. You know, that, you know, Trump is arguing in states where he lost by hundreds of thousands of votes that, you know, there were some irregularities and this would deliver him the state potentially. Whereas like somewhere like Florida in 2000, it actually was just like hundreds of votes. So if the, yeah, if the election was closer the way that 2000 was, you wonder if the Republican, I just feel like the Republicans would be much more gung-ho about stealing this thing, right? And I think kind of like they see the writing, many of them see the writing on the wall in terms of this not shaking out. But you do wonder going forward what elections are going to look like if every time, you know, Republicans have to realize that they are, it's becoming harder and harder for them to win. They don't win the popular vote really ever anymore. It's just going to be a question of what, can we cast enough doubt on this process? And also just going forward, what happens to these Trump people who are going to believe that it was in fact stolen and that he's still the rightful president. And maybe the movie is like a media empire, like something to the right of Fox. It just seems like there's like this new alternative to Twitter, Parler, which is, you know, like a right-wing version of Twitter. Yeah, someone told me there's like a GoFundMe one coming because GoFundMe is shutting down kind of like some of these right-wing attempts to raise money and going to develop like a whole other like right-wing network that kind of exists outside of the mainstream media beyond just like Fox News and the things that we've been accustomed to for all these years.
The Republican Party just continues to be pulled farther and farther into the fringier right. It is shocking just how many people voted for Donald Trump this time.
You know, like Trump, it's almost like a catch-22 for the Republican Party because it is in some ways like they're tethered to him, right? Like because he's so polarizing, he motivated so many people to go out and vote against him, but also got more Republicans to vote for him this time than did in 2016. So on some level, you think like, of course, the Republican Party is going to have to move beyond this guy. But I just don't see, you know, can you picture a Marco Rubio or like who can do it better? Like who can do this whole shtick and this whole con and this whole grift and pack stadiums and have people not believing a pandemic is actually real or whatever? I don't know. I just don't see, and you know, like the names that people throw out, like the Tom Cottons or the Tucker Carlsons or whatever, I just don't see it, honestly, like not in the same way. Like I'm sure those people would have supporters. I'm sure like people would vote for a Marco Rubio or Mitt Romney or if they wanted to run a more establishment Republican figure. But you know, the thing with Trump is just like people do love him and they do buy into it. And over 70 million people voted for him. So I just, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the Republican Party next. Cause it's kind of, Trumpism has already like affected, as you say, like infected the party and effectively taken it over. So it's going to be a very difficult thing to put back in the bottle if they want to run in a different direction. I saw, you know, Marco Rubio make a statement that he wanted the GOP to rebrand as like a more multi-ethnic working class party, which, you know, sounds really good, but I don't, what does that look like in the context of like Trumpism engulfing everything else? I don't know.
Imagine if Donald Trump had not botched the COVID-19 response.
Right.
Imagine if they had provided enough PPE and ventilators and, you know, gotten behind the mask mandate and a lockdown and that we weren't experiencing what we're experiencing now. I think he would have won easily. I think we lucked out this time, this brush with absolute minority rule, neo-fascism, because he's so incompetent. If this was hanging chads in 2000 again, there would absolutely be a coup happening.
Yeah, and Trump also totally.
But that's not what's happening now.
Yeah, right. I mean, Trump also tipped his hand, right? By, you know, like you had people like Bernie Sanders essentially calling what was going to happen with the mail-in votes in terms of him declaring himself winner. And like, again, you know, like the 2000 situation was just the opposite. Like, you know, Al Gore kind of had this like legal approach to it. The Democratic Party effectively shut down all these labor groups that were trying to do big protests in Florida. And they let the Republicans kind of seize the narrative. In contrast to this, where it seems like the Biden people and the Democrats really expected Trump to do this, right? So it's like they had it all queued up, came out, talked like he was the new president, like everything about it was just kind of, you know, a 180. And it's not like, you know, like obviously the Gore team back then had no idea what the situation would be like in Florida. But in retrospect, you do wonder, because of everything that happened after with Bush, what would have happened if the Democrats kind of were able to seize that narrative. But it became, you know, the Brooks Brothers riots, the Gore loser stuff, and then it was the Supreme Court sealed it. So, yeah.
All right, let's now talk about what's happening to Reverend Raphael Warnock in Georgia. It felt like people were still in line to vote, and the anti-Israel attacks against him from the Loeffler campaign already started. Bring us up to speed and explain the clip that we heard at the top of the show. It was kind of long. Tell us what that was, and tell us what's going on in that race.
Sure. So just to take a step back before we talk about that clip, once the runoff was announced, or shortly after it was announced, this 2019 letter resurfaced. It was published by the Jewish Insider, and it had been published originally on the website of the National Council of Churches. It was this letter that was signed by a bunch of Christian leaders. It had coincided with a delegation of leaders who had gone to Israel and Palestine. And it had been signed by Reverend Raphael Warnock, the Democratic candidate for the seat. It became controversial, or it was attacked because this letter compared the conditions of the West Bank to those of apartheid South Africa. There were two versions of this letter. One he signed did not have this part in it, but there was a second version of the letter, which had all the same text plus some added features. Some of the added text referred to conditioning aid to Israel, but he had not signed that one. So anyway, that became something of a online controversy, some people referring to him as anti-Israel online. Then a few days after, I guess, this 2018 sermon, which we heard at the beginning of the show, begins making the rounds, where everybody probably heard it, but he talks about the Israeli government or the IDF shooting nonviolent protesters. He, you know, makes these direct parallels between Black Lives Matter and the situation on the ground in Palestine. And something he also says is that he says that to defend, you know, these nonviolent protesters who were shot by the IDF is not anti-Semitic. And he says it's no more I'm paraphrasing, but he says something like it's no more anti-Semitic. Essentially calling somebody anti-Semitic for saying that is similar to calling the Black Lives Matter movement anti-white. This obviously creates a backlash from the Loeffler campaign, who puts out a statement about Warnock's alleged anti-Israel extremism. And her response to this, I guess, prompts Warnock or the people around Warnock to draft this editorial for the Jewish Insider called "I Stand with Israel," which kind of hits all the beats when it comes to this kind of stuff in there about how Israel is a great democracy, its unique historical importance. He talks about how he supports the two-state solution. He points out that, like Joe Biden, he does not support conditioning aid to Israel or military aid to Israel or cutting off any of the billions of dollars that it gets every year. He even has this part where he takes some shots at BDS. He says that he supports the First Amendment. He invokes John Lewis when he says he supports the First Amendment and the right to protest, but he says he strongly opposes the BDS movement and asserts that it has anti-Semitic underpinnings and that it's an impediment to peace, which is, you know, these are all standard kind of catchphrases that we've heard time and time again from critics of BDS. So that's kind of where we're at. So he continues to, he moves, you know, further to the right on this issue, or is continuing to play up his pro-his Israel record and claiming that he's a friend of the country, while he's being attacked by the right and the Loeffler campaign for, you know, allegedly being anti-Semitic. And the other thing here is that he also, another part of this controversy is that some audio, I guess, was also surfaced where he is defending Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who people probably remember from another political scandal of sorts.
Oh, wow. It's a deep album cut.
Deep album cut was, you know, everybody probably remembers, led the church that former President Barack Obama used to belong to. I think he dropped out of the church or left the church, yep, after this video surfaced of Jeremiah Wright, his famous speech, "Goddamn America," this whole like anti-imperial sermon that he gave. So he, you know, that was used by members of the right to kind of paint Obama at the time in 2008 as anti-American and as, you know, secret Muslim and all this kind of stuff, and anti-Semitic and anti-Israel and pro-Palestine. And yeah, so he's making an appearance on this controversy as well. So that's kind of where we're at. And I would just also point out with Loeffler, you know, this is not surprising. It's, you know, GOP hypocrisy is not really maybe something to give too much time or thought to.
It's not breaking news anymore.
It's not breaking news, but it's worth pointing out that this is a woman who is supported and was backed by Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, of course, is the infamous conspiracy theorist who's heading to the House in January, who also won her seat in Georgia in the recent election. Yeah, so that's where we're at with this. It's very, you know, we talk a lot at the website, or we write about how these things are shifting, right? Whether it's Betty McCollum's bill or things that Ilhan Omar or Sheeta Tlaib say, or, you know, BDS, you know, more Democrats now, you know, we have all these Democrats headed to Congress in January who support conditioning aid to Israel, like Cori Bush. This is kind of a tale we've seen many times, and it's playing out kind of in a very predictable, kind of depressing way. So for all the you know, the Israel lobby has really taken some huge hits this election cycle, right? Like losing Elliot Engel certainly was like a huge blow. They've had a lot of big blows recently, but you know, this kind of does show that politicians, or at least Warnock's people in this situation, think obviously that this editorial is necessary to net voters or to not lose voters potentially. So it is kind of a commentary that despite the fact there's been some progress on the area, that in this area, there's obviously a long way to go when it comes to this stuff.
It was disappointing to see him immediately accept the premise of their attack and shift to the back foot on it, and now try to dig into Israel lobby talking points to dig himself out of whatever hole he thinks he's in. I think he should have just acknowledged it and said yes and tried to pivot to talk about issues that actually affect people in Georgia more than Israel. Whether or not that's going to be the issue that turns out the vote in Georgia, do enough people care about Israel enough in Georgia to vote? I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, that was my, if there ever was an election where really what these candidates say matter, I mean, you know, the GOP and the Democrats are very focused on Georgia for very obvious reasons. It's going to determine who controls the Senate. So I'm not sure if any of these controversies are bringing people to the polls or keeping them away from the polls. But to your point, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think there is the space now, as we've talked about, where you could just do the you know, like the typical two-state solution thing, say a lot of nothing, make it seem like you're saying something. You know, to go the extra mile and say, like, I also don't think military aid should be conditioned. You know, you could have just said, I oppose the BDS movement, as some Democrats do. I don't think it's like the right vehicle for peace. But, you know, to have to smear it as anti-Semitic seemed like an extra step that I'm not sure what the motivation was or why that was completely necessary. So, yeah, to use your phrase, it is very disheartening.
I think what happens is people get into a position where they think they're going to win. They think they have a chance. And I'm just not sure that in an election like that, where Trump is now off the table, he's going to win in Georgia. In the meantime, the other race, John Ossoff, has made it clear that he doesn't have a problem with Israel doing whatever it wants.
That is true. And, you know, there's this clip going around of him saying he doesn't support Medicare for All. He doesn't support the Green New Deal. He doesn't support all these progressive programs. The filibuster, he says he's still thinking about it.
Maybe.
It's a maybe.
Maybe.
So he's not exactly, you know, like, yeah, filling people up with excitement, I don't think, either. So, yeah, it would be nice if, you know, he potentially came to the defense. I mean, I don't know if he has at all or how those two races are coordinated in any way, but Ossoff is Jewish. I mean, it just seems like maybe kind of like a logical thing to stand up to against these attacks against Warnock. Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens, but it's you know, like we were saying, like I'm not even sure if it matters. I don't know what the idea is. I think they both think that they can win, to your point, and they are saying what they think can draw in voters. I mean, it's very reminiscent of what we just saw with Biden in terms of the Democrat strategy with that. And now there's this whole debate, you know, regarding this kind of battle for the soul of the Democratic Party, right? In terms of, you know, who turns out voters and what the future of it looks like. And, you know, this old guard, or however you want to put it, centrism, is really digging in their nails when it comes to this stuff. You know, a lot of attacks against politicians like AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. Ossoff, it's also interesting. He's only like 33 years old. Like, you know, he's obviously throwing his hat in with, you know, the Pelosi's and Clyburns of the world, but, you know, he's
already got some losses on it under his belt.
Yeah.
Like Amy McGrath in Kentucky. How many times are these folks going to run and lose and spend huge amounts of money? At the end of your newsletter, Michael, you always offer up some odds and ends, some short things people should take a look at. What are you looking at this week? What should people pay attention to?
JVP Action launched a pledge demanding that the Biden administration stop funding Israeli apartheid. I mean, we see pledges like this a lot from these kind of groups, but it is something to, I think the last time we chatted on here, we talked about how it'll be interesting going forward to see how groups like JVP Action, if not now, some of these other groups that have developed political wings of their organizations and have actually endorsed candidates and policies and legislation and things like this, what the space kind of looks like for them moving forward post-election. So I think you know, what that group does and what similar groups do, whether it's progressive Jewish groups or Muslim groups or U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, et cetera. Their moves in the coming months leading up to January will be interesting. I put in there, you know, Ilhan Omar tweeted, while the world was kind of focused on our election, Israel destroyed about 80 Palestinian homes, I think, in the West Bank. And Ilhan Omar tweeted that it was a grave crime and a direct violation of international law. The GOP-led Senate Appropriations Committee is proposing a $696 billion Pentagon spending bill for the fiscal year, which is pretty notable considering what's going on in this country at the time, at the moment, in terms of unemployment and poverty and pandemics. Report today, I guess, as a parallel to this, that, you know, the Trump administration seems kind of bored with the idea of a second stimulus. That's like something to keep in mind when you read stories like that. Today, there was a panel on Palestine at the United Nations, and Minnesota Representative Betty McCollum, who we cover quite a bit at the site because she's sponsors legislation that's relevant to us, gave some remarks. And I just have a quote from here in the odds and ends section, which I'll just quickly read. She said, "Palestinian dreams for freedom, justice, equality, and self-determination are legitimate. Every Palestinian mother and father want a life free from military occupation and systemic discrimination for their child. And every Palestinian child's life is precious." Betty McCollum, of course, is the sponsor of a bill promoting human rights for Palestinian children in the House, which would cut off U.S. funding for military detention of Palestinian kids in Israel. So those are some things that stood out to me this week that made their way into the newsletter.
Question we have is, how do you refute the accusations against BDS being anti-Semitic?
The BDS movement shouldn't have to be on the defensive. And I think there's been it's been put on the defensive because this claim has been made and repeated and it hasn't been effectively refuted. But I think it's completely unfair and incorrect for the BDS. I mean, first of all, my understanding is that people who have endorsed BDS and who support it don't even refer to it as a movement, but rather as a tactic that is used by people who support who join common cause and respond to Palestinian civil society, which asked the world to show their support through this using this mechanism to express dissatisfaction with the state of normal diplomacy of international relations, which has completely failed the Palestinians in their quest for human rights. I mean, you have a people who have clear legal rights recognized at the international level. Perhaps no other stateless people have attained such a degree of success in having their existence affirmed and repeatedly called for realization at the international legal level, yet frustrated at the level of international diplomacy. And so this is a grassroots response to the failure of states. And it's a nonviolent movement, and it's calling for nothing more than the implementation of human rights. And so I think defenders of BDS ought not to be defensive and ought to ask those who ask the question about BDS being anti-Semitic to justify the question. And by turning it on its head that way, I think that can be...
I'd like to add something to that. You know, the reason the BDS came into effect is because the governments, Western governments, are not fulfilling their duty to defend international law and human rights. When Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, Canada imposed sanctions on Iraq. When Russia annexed the Crimea, which, by the way, had a majority of Russians who voted to join Russia, Canada imposed sanctions on Russia. Yet here do we have Israel, which has annexed East Jerusalem in 1980, annexed the Golan Heights in 1981, has moved hundreds of thousands of Jewish Israelis into Jewish-only colonies in the West Bank, has placed 2 million Palestinians in an open-air prison, like a concentration camp. And Canada has not done anything but verbal words sometimes. So this is why you needed a popular civil movement like BDS, which was initiated by the Palestinians and has supporters all over the world. So if Canada does its duty as it did in Iraq and the Crimea, there would be no need for a BDS movement. But the BDS movement is coming in because the Canadian government has failed to do its duty in defending international law and human rights.
So I would just, I certainly agree with both Khaled and Faisal's remarks. And I would add to Faisal's comments that, I mean, yeah, those asking the question have to sort of be, the onus has to be put on them to justify what the basis for the question is, right? So you can turn it back around and just say, okay, here are the three demands of BDS. Point out to me where there's anything anti-Semitic in them, or where there's anything even to do with with Judaism or any other religion, when you have three demands that are, one, the internationally recognized right of Palestinian refugees to return, two, the end to the illegal occupations of Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, three, the right of the Palestinian citizens of Israel to equal status. Okay, so what does this have to do with any religion? This has to do with a political entity that came into being in 1948 with a modern political movement articulated by a Hungarian writer in the 1890s. This is not in any way intrinsic to a 5,000-year-old religion. And I think that we can draw analogies, and that helps people understand, right? So this, you know, you can pose the question back to you. Well, if is BDS anti-Semitic? I mean, that's roughly like asking, is Black Lives Matter, reverse racism against white people, okay? That's generally recognized, unfortunately not universally, but generally recognized to be an absurd proposition. I think we can draw a fair analogy here. Are the indigenous struggles for liberation inside of the lands that we live on here, are they, discriminatory against Europeans and white people or others who have settled here? Again, I think that's pretty widely seen to be an indefensible proposition. So I think these analogies can help declutter some of the obfuscations that have gone on around the Palestinian issue.
Okay, if there are no final comments to that question, that wraps up the Q&A portion of the webinar, which brings us to the end. So thank you so much again, everyone. Stay safe and take care. وإن جارت علي عزيزة وقومي وإن ضنوا علي كرام بلادي وإن جارت علي عزيزة وقومي وإن ضنوا علي كرام غريب وبقلبك يا وطني أوطاني وبشعر بالغربة ومحبوبي عمر ما عيني بعيد عني وأنا بقربة غريب وبقلبك يا وطني أوطاني وبشعر بالغربة ومحبوبي عمر ما عيني بعيد عني وانا بقربة يا 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 بلدي يا 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 بلدي
بعدك وبقلبي يا غالي لو بانوا بينا جدار عالي حتى لو يحرمني شوفك ضل احلم فيك وبخيالي بعدك وبقلبي يا غالي لو بانوا بينا جدار عالي حتى لو يحرمني شوفك ضل احلم فيك وبخيالي يا
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.